Hello, my name is Carol May Wittick and welcome to HER Conversations, Tools for the Awakening Woman. HER is an acronym for Higher Energetic Resonance. This is the optimal state to embody in order to attract our highest desires. And who is the Awakening Woman? She's a woman seeking a greater possibility in her reality and she's looking for solutions. She knows being awakened is not a lofty ideal, but a necessity. If she can transform herself, she can change the world. HER Conversations will introduce you to talented women who will speak to your spirituality, sensuality, and your soul. They share their stories and explain how they are in service to the world. So let their words and these conversations embolden and inspire you. This week, I'm speaking to Anita McKenzie. Anita is an interfaith minister, a raw food coach, and founder of Sister in the Raw. During our conversation, she talks about her role as an interfaith minister, her work with food, and how she is aiming to combine those two worlds. Other topics discussed include understanding the energy of food, developing conscious awareness around our bodies, learning compassionate eating, and also what we should do and how we should treat ourselves when we think we've slipped up after beginning a healthy eating regime. Food is pivotal to our survival, but only if we get it right. Yet there are so few of us who understand how to discover what works for us. We're all leading different lives and as a result have different dietary needs. Speaking to Anita gave me, someone who's always striving for better health, so many insights, and I know that there are many takeaways for you too. But before we get to that, I ask Anita the HER Conversations opening question. HER is an acronym for Higher Energetic Resonance. When do you feel at your most HER?
I thought a lot about this question and the first word that came to me was meditation. And I thought, well, what is it about meditation? But then I kind of like, in considering it, I thought, well, actually it's devotion. I feel that higher resonance mostly when I'm in a space that's devotional, and that could be any of a number of types of spaces, you know, like communing out in nature or being in a sacred space, you know, like in a temple or a church or whatever, or kind of like communing with someone else as a spiritual counselor and doing that three-way process that is, you know, where spirit is present and, you know, you're kind of like working with that energy to manifest different types of things. So yeah, it is a kind of like devotional state for me and happens most in my role as an interfaith minister and also when I'm teaching and also when I'm getting hugs from my granddaughter.
That's a nice one. Everyone has a journey, everyone has a story that leads them to the work that they do where they feel that they're being most of service and they're really on purpose. So I'm interested to find out what your story is, what has brought you to where you are now.
I could go a long way back and sort of say that partly it's ancestral and then, you know, family and community and cultural background and a personal experience, kind of like in that kind of like order really. So in terms of ancestry and family, I come from an African heritage and an Indian Hindu heritage family, and I was brought up Catholic and didn't really understand it as a child because all of the services were in Latin back in those days, and went through that period of rejecting religion and spirit, everything. I just didn't want to know. You couldn't talk to me about it. It was like, please, I don't want to hear it. And I remember growing up as a child listening to my mum and my aunt's back home stories, and especially their stories about Duppy, about spirit. And it terrified the living daylights out of me. But I was always aware from the things that my mum said of this otherworldly type thing always running in the background. And so sort of fast forward to my 30s, I went on a Buddhist meditation retreat for Black people. And that was a huge turning point in my life. My children were teenagers, and I was experiencing many of the things that you do with teenage children, which was a little bit stressful. And I discovered meditation, which was absolutely beautiful, mindfulness of breathing, and metta bhavana, which teaches you all about compassion. And that learning about compassion and how it operates within yourself and within the world, and how if you look through the lens of compassion at your experiences, how it just changes everything up. And that was a really huge turning point for me. It allowed me to kind of like put down some of the angst, some of the experiences from the past. And then it just really continued from there. I was deeply into Buddhism for about 7 or 8 years, and I traveled to India and did the Buddhist path, and you know, learnt Vipassana meditation and stayed in a Buddhist temple, and you know, but it was deeply insightful and really helped me to grow on my spiritual journey. And then I discovered by accident, and you know, we know that nothing's really by accident, the Interfaith Seminary, that's what it was called at the time, it's now One Spirit Interfaith Foundation. And I saw the interfaith ministers training, and what I loved about it was that it covered all the major religions and other things as well. And I'd reached a point in my life where I felt that I didn't want to have to choose either one path or another path, because I felt them all within me. And that was difficult around some of the people that I knew who had very firm, specific beliefs. So I did the training, and it was a real opening. It was deeply, deeply opening. And I remember the woman who Miranda Holden at the time, she's Miranda McPherson now, was a blonde, white, Australian woman. And it was so challenging for me to accept a white woman as my spiritual teacher. But she never shrunk away from the things I was bringing as a black woman. And she, you know, she brought her compassion, her whole spirit to just holding the space for everyone that was in it. I have great respect for her. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful experience. I think I had my ordination in 2006. So I do the things that whenever people ask me, oh, what's an interfaith minister? Because they always do. They never know. And I explain that it's a non-denominational role. I do the things that ministers do. I, you know, conduct funerals and weddings and blessings and lots more besides. And each interfaith minister brings their own life experience and understanding and faith belief system to their role. So we're not a church, so we don't have like a physical space. It's a body and a network of people. And so offering similar and different things. So I love the fact that I can create ceremony for people to mark milestones in their life, and so that they feel really fulfilled by the experience of ceremony and ritual. And I discovered through the process that I do like ritual. It feels perfect for me, and it resonates very deeply for me. But I do believe that that's also connected to my ancestral inheritance as well. So now I still do those things, you know, create rituals and ceremonies for people. And And I work with food as well. And I see it all as part of an holistic journey. And so the food is something that also kind of has its own energy. So it's part of my ministry, the whole well-being, you know, kind of like grounding, healthy, healing, lifestyle genre that is my life now. I don't know if that answers your question though.
And I wanted to kind of just expand on just how you got into food, really. You're talking about healing as well. And a lot of people who get into healing of some sort, it always stems after some sort of experience that they've had themselves, and then them healing themselves as a result, and then going into the work because it made such a difference in their life. So was there a pivotal point? Was there a condition that you were going through or an experience in life that brought you to awareness of how, you know, what food could do and how detrimental food could be if you were not choosing the right ones? And then also how healing it could be, because obviously coming from a very kind of dense cultural background where food is everything, a lot of the time as well, especially in the Black communities, the food that we know and love as our food and take on board is not necessarily the best food for health in the long term, really. And it's one of those things that's very difficult to kind of explain to family members, that the food that they know and love so well is actually causing them detrimental experience in life. But what was your raw experience? What brought you into food?
We were very poor when we were growing up, mm-hmm. and there wasn't a lot of food around. My mum was very health conscious. Her thing was, you know, with Sunday dinner, rice and peas and chicken or whatever, we would have a salad. There was always a salad on the table, always. And it consisted of lettuce, carrots, peppers, cucumber and tomatoes. That was it. But we loved it. We absolutely adored it. And it was like, and vegetables. We always had vegetables with our meals, you know, carrots or peas or whatever. And it wasn't a big deal, but it was normal. And as my mum got older and she developed certain conditions like arthritis and things like that, she tried to become even more healthy by taking supplements and those kinds of things. And she'd read a little article in a magazine, and then she'd act on what she'd read. I think in my 30s, a series of things happened. I started to get migraine headaches, which I'd never had in my life before. And I had just moved into a new home. I had a young baby. I had three children, and, you know, I was convinced that I had a brain tumour. And I went to my GP and told her that I wanted a brain scan. And she told me that she thought it was stress, and I didn't believe her. I didn't know anything very deeply about stress. I hadn't, you know, the whole thing about stress and me wasn't part of my world. And, you know, time proved her right. It was stress. But the migraines were really severe. I would not be able to move for at least maybe for a couple of days. I would just have to lie very, very still and not do anything. And then later on, I developed ulcers, stomach ulcers, which were, before I realized that's what it was, I was suffering with so much pain, and I couldn't eat very much, or I could only eat certain things, otherwise they would cause real discomfort. And I think it was around that time, it was kind of like, it seems to happen, you know, I started to pursue or explore Buddhism, and these things were happening as well. And then you kind of like find yourself in an environment where you're exposed to the elements or the fragments coming together. So mm-hmm. the things about lifestyle and your choices and how certain choices can impact you in this way or that way, and that kind of thinking. And so I started to read a lot, and, you know, Louise Hay and different people. And I think that was it. That was the kind of like the crux of it. But it feels like I'd always had some kind of health influence in my life, mm-hmm. but that when I got ill, that was the point at which you know, I was far too young to be having those kinds of symptoms. And once I changed my diet, I realized it was my own experience of not being well. And I had an inflamed colon, I had high blood pressure, and I was told by three different health practitioners that if I didn't do something about my blood pressure, I would have a stroke. I really thought about it, because I didn't know anything about blood pressure, and I read about it, and I thought, well, actually, I don't have any grandchildren yet, but if I do, I want to be alive to see them grow up. And that was that forms part of my thinking about it as well. And then I read Dr. Leila Africa's book, I can't remember which one it was, in which he talked about the causes of blood pressure and the lack of nutrients to the organs. And I thought, wow, this is new. Nobody else is saying this. The doctor is telling me that it's either hereditary or it's this or it's that, and there's nothing that I can do about it. And in reading that new information, I realized a couple of things. I'd never been a person who drank water. I'd always loved fizzy drinks, and I used to drink like a bottle full in an evening. And I mean a big bottle. And I still ate our traditional food. And at this point, I'm learning about food combining and thinking, oh my goodness, our food is not healthy. Not in the way that we eat it, not in the way that we prepare it. I'd already cut out sugar, as much sugar as I could, and salt out of my diet, but it wasn't enough. And I think that was when I started to really deeply, consciously think about what it was I was eating, how I was preparing my food, how I was thinking about my food, how I thought about my body, what I was putting in my body, what I'd done in the past, and how it was impacting on me in the present. That was the journey where I started to play around with or explore different types of eating regimes, I would call them. Not dieting, because I'm not a dieter, but, you know, kind of like cutting out this. I cut out all red meat and chicken and fish for a long time, which is what a lot of people do, because I thought chicken and fish was healthier, and then it turns out that they're not. And then I became a vegetarian, and then, you know, you discover that lots of vegetarian food is really unhealthy, all the cheese and everything else. And then kind of like slowly vegan, then raw, then, you know, and the raw has made the biggest impact in my life, in terms of including juicing and sprouts and that kind of thing. So in that last long episode where I had an inflamed colon, I did a 30-day juice fast. At that point, I was in so much pain, I didn't care if I never ate again. And after about 6 days, the pain went completely. And my energy levels just soared. And I wouldn't have known that this was possible if I didn't do that. And the 30 days, it wasn't too hard. I mean, my daughter supported me in terms of bringing juices to work and things like that. But I was absolutely fine. I lost 2 stone. I felt so strong and so energized. That was it. That was the kind of like the real big shift. Mm. And that's when I decided to learn more about raw food, train as a raw food teacher, and everything else that I've done since.
And so then when did you start to implement that out to incorporate kind of treating people, for want of a better word, with the food? So spreading your message and what you've learned, how did that kind of start your this side of the business, like the sister in the raw and everything?
I went on a raw food mastery course, which I just came across, and I'm really glad that I did, because that really helped me to begin to implement some of the things that I was learning in my own life. And then I had my whole family to negotiate at that point as well. My mum telling me, oh no, Anita, you can't eat raw planting because it will hurt your tummy, and all of those kind of things, and really struggling with these kind of messages that were contradicting each other. Mm. You know, but that was part and parcel of the process. I was so in awe of the experience that I was having, the health that it brought to my life, that I then decided to go off and train to teach about raw food. So I did the Alyssa Cohen level 1 and level 2 to begin with, because that was all that was available in this country at the time. And I taught for a while, and then I worked with people like Darren Bippo, and I went on as many workshops as I could find, read everything that was available, you know, went to listen to Victoria Batango talk and Brian Clements whenever he came to the country, and I was just waiting. I feel like I was biding my time until I was able to go and work, you know, go and do the Hippocrates health educator course, do the Colin Campbell's plant-based nutrition, and work with Ari Slatham to do his Sunfied Culinary Institute course as well, his certification. And because I knew that there were things that I didn't know, but I wasn't quite sure what it was that I didn't know. And those things are just not available really in the UK at the moment. And there's a complete shift in mindset from traditional approaches to nutrition. So what I've learned more than anything else though is about our complete and utter uniqueness as human beings, and that not one approach suits everybody. So with my teacher initially, it was like, yeah, okay, go raw for 30 days, that's it, you know, kind of like hardcore, you know, just do it, kind of like, and I'd be starving. I don't say that to people. It's like, okay, you know, let's try the raw and see how you get on with it, and you know, these are the things that you can implement, these are the things that you can change, let's take it at a pace that feels right for you, and we'll monitor it as close as possible as we go along. For some people, 100% raw is just definitely not going to happen. 80%, 60% maybe. You know, there are certain things that they're able to change, and change, lifestyle change takes time, it takes years. You know, initially when people get all gung-ho and they're really, really enthusiastic, which is wonderful, you know, they'll do it. But then later on, you know, sustaining it becomes more of a challenge. And that's when you really need to have the tools and the support to be able to keep going. That's what I've learned, as much for myself as for anybody else.
So the next question that I wanted to go into is, with food, and especially how it pertains to women, because food and eating is so emotive. Food is surrounded by so much celebration. You eat because you're happy. We eat as women, and we're marketing food to kind of like deal with our sad days, our down days, the days that we've got a period, the day that we have an argument with our boyfriend, you know, when we're celebrating. It's like food, food, food is everywhere. And then conversely, we've got this kind of body image thing as well going on. So it's like, how can we start to develop more conscious awareness and also compassion about the way that we need to feed our bodies with food?
That's a huge question.
Take your time.
Okay, so the messages that we receive as girls primarily, and you know, having had daughters and now a granddaughter, and the women in my life, in my family, it's all the things that are said to you, all the things that are said to you that kind of like affect what you'll choose to eat and when you'll choose certain things to eat. What can I say about that? It takes time. It's a journey to reach a point where you feel self-empowered and enabled to kind of like put down some of the messages that you've received, and to have the power of self-determination in relation to your body image. And, you know, working on your internal stuff about your own body image, because it starts with you. Nobody can do it for you. So that you can kind of like deflect and push back those messages that are still going to come. And I guess I can talk about it from personal experience, from having been really skinny when I was young, and all the things that were said to me about being really, really thin that really distressed me when I was a girl, to putting on weight after becoming a mother and now being middle-aged, and how all of those things affect your life, your cycle with yourself, your relationship with food, and the choices that you make. So it's about education. I'm very aware that we are really mindful with my granddaughter around what we say to her and how we speak about things that affect self-esteem and body image. Mm. Because I've witnessed it myself in terms of hearing what other people say to young girls when they get to puberty and they might put on a little bit of weight, and you know, things that are said about that. I've witnessed it in my own family and I've seen the results of that that has. I meet young women all the time who will tell me that they can't eat certain things or they can't eat a certain amount of food because they're fat. And really, really, I'm astounded by that level of self-judgment, when, especially when it's not true. And the kind of like fear that's embroiled in that, in terms of, you know, not being acceptable in whatever environment that you're in. And I can remember with my eldest daughter, I think she was in her 20s or her late teens, maybe early 20s, when the Spice Girls were really kind of at their, you know, coming into their own and being really concerned about the messages that were being, that she was receiving from them in terms of, you know, her own body image and what she felt she wanted to look like. So I think that it's on so many different levels, you know, public people who are in the public eye, who influence young girls. You know, these days it's all about social media. It's what they watch on YouTube and what they, you know, from on their phones and on their tablets, and those kinds of messages. But I do believe that people are beginning to become more mindful about that. It's also about things like the kind of food that young women see in supermarkets on food, in relation to food. And I was really pleased to see a few weeks ago that the UK government had passed some legislation which is taking away the gender traditions from advertising images. So like, you know, you can't put only girls in a leotard, and you can't have only boys playing football. And, you know, it's kind of like taking away those sort of gender stereotypes. So I think that will really help in terms of sending a message that we're capable of doing lots of different things, no matter what age we are, no matter what size we are. However, there's also the thing that goes alongside that is about doing whatever you do in a healthy way.
Yeah.
So if you're eating healthily, you really haven't got too much to worry about, unless you're obese. And we know that the obesity figures in UK in children is particularly high. And in some communities like our own, it's particularly high. Mm-hmm. And that's worrying. So then, you know, that also comes back to, you know, what children are eating, what parents are preparing for the children if they're eating lots of processed foods. But then attached to that are all kinds of other issues, like, you know, parents having to work long hours to earn enough money to do, you know, pay the bills. And, you know, so it's kind of, it's not just one thing. And so I think the whole thing about getting back into the kitchen, one of the things that I get asked a lot is, yeah, but isn't your lifestyle really expensive? Isn't it, you know, doesn't eating organic food mean this and this? And I know that some children will, on their way home from school, buy a packet, a thing of chicken, because that's the only meal they're going to get that night. Their parents are not going to be home to cook for them. It's a huge question, and I kind of like, I'm going round and round and round, but I'm thinking about that whole thing about teaching young women to honor themselves is a huge part of how we can support girls and women to have a better relationship with themselves. And the knock-on from that is with food, that, you know, their own energy and the energy of food. And, you know, kind of like, instead of using Clearasil for your pimples, have a green juice in the morning. I don't know. it's that kind of thing. I don't know if Clearasil exists anymore, but, you know, those are the adverts I remember on the television when I was a young woman, and thinking about, you know, and using it to kind of like cleanse my face, because, you know, there was no connection between having fizzy drinks or sodas and the amount of sugar in your body, and therefore, you know, skin eruptions that might happen. So that can happen in schools. You can teach children that in schools. How effective it is, is that I don't know. And hopefully it is. Young women tend to listen more to each other than they do to their parents or teachers, and, you know, watch more of what's on social media. So I don't know really what's out there for them in terms of health. And I know that there are all kinds of kind of like, is it Girl God? And, you know, there are some really powerful, empowering and political gender movements, but where it takes into account health and nutrition, I don't know.
And you spoke about the energy of food as well. How, you know, I know for myself now, it's whether I'm reading, I don't know whether I'm reading the energy of food or whether I make a choice now as to knowing that if I'm going to eat a certain thing, the consequences are going to be this, how I'm going to feel in my body. And I've tried to put the guilt of kind of eating a certain amount a day. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. But it's more so how I feel, if it's going to make me feel sleepy or slow or anything like that. How can someone kind of get onto that, especially when most of our eating is so unconscious? And like you say, everyone feels like they're so time poor. So convenience overrules health when you're making choices for food as well.
Well, I think that you've really got the crux of it. It is about, you know, when I eat this, I feel this. It's about connecting the two things. And therefore, you know, developing a level of self-awareness, physical self-awareness, and then connecting that to your actions is, I think, really a really big part of that process of understanding the laws around energy, because, and that they're all connected. So, for instance, you know, I remember kind of like being horrified by some of my earlier raw food teachers, but, you know, things like, well, you know, if you put a shepherd's pie in the oven, it, you know, it's processed food, B, it's dead food, and C, in the sense that it has very little nutritional value. And when you eat processed dead food, this is the impact that it has on your body, and this is why you end up feeling this, this, and this. Do that over a lifetime, and not even, you know, a short span of lifetime now, you know, till the age of 10, 15, 20, because we're seeing those results now. This is what could happen. But young people don't deal with could, they deal with what, you know, the immediate. And so I think it's teaching them how to notice and recognize how the energy changes, and we can do that. You can do that in all kinds of things. You can do that through teaching self-awareness, through kind of like meditation. But I don't normally call it meditation. I would call it kind of like a relaxation practice, so that they can notice. And Vipassana meditation, it, in a sense, is fantastic for that, because it teaches you how to kind of like notice the flow of energy in your body. And you can do that through lots of different things as well. So introducing, I think, those concepts and ideas as early as possible is really important. And then, because when you start to honor yourself, you begin to understand that everything is connected. So if you're growing carrots in the garden, or pumpkins in the garden, or courgettes or cucumbers or whatever, they're alive and they're growing. And when you go and pick them, they're coming from the earth, and they have a certain amount of the earth life, you know, life force energy in them. And that's the best time to eat them. That's not a concept that is difficult for children to understand or for young people to understand. It's not a concept that's difficult for any of us to understand. And therefore, the more you introduce that kind of like natural, clean life force into your body, the more you're feeding your organs what they need at a cellular level. And I think it's just about kind of like pitting those two concepts by helping people to understand, if you have this, there's no nutritional value. So therefore, your body is starving. And you might be getting up and going to work every day, but the reason why you feel tired, the reason why you've got gluten intolerance, the reason why you're bloated, you know, the reason why, you know, you need to have 10 hours sleep at night is because of that. Try this, and then you will discover that because your body is being given nutrient-dense food with all the vitamins, minerals, and everything else that it needs, and get rid of the fizzy drinks, or just take out the dairy for a while and have a green smoothie 3 times a week. See how you go. And then people are really surprised at the almost immediate difference that that makes to how they feel. And it's that how you feel, which you talked about in your question, that helps people to understand that there's a resonance, an energetic resonance with the food that they eat, and therefore they can begin to kind of like help make healthier choices. But until someone is willing to do that, I think it's really hard. It can be a difficult concept to understand, because it's so experiential that, you know, I believe that that's what makes the difference for a lot of people.
Taking that step. And one thing I've noticed more of is more people are almost choosing and stepping into, if not immediately veganism, but vegetarianism as well, because they're kind of realizing that, and that could be like after a lifetime of thinking that meat was the best source of protein, but maybe even in a not overly conscious way, they're feeling that meat is not right for them anymore. And what are you noticing about that as well? Because there's being such an awakening within people, and they're moving away from feeling that they have to have meat on every single plate that they eat, you know.
Well, that's a kind of like, it's very, that's very Western, isn't it? You know, kind of like having your, you know, traditionally, you know, and it's only in the last maybe 50 years or so that meat has been a sense of a meal. And for a lot of people, it designates some kind of affluence. You know, they can afford to have meat, whereas in the past we didn't eat very much meat. And also we've got the meat industry, you know, kind of like pushing that message to us all the time. And I think people come to vegetarianism for different reasons. Sometimes it's health reasons, sometimes it's to do with not wanting to cause, causing harm and suffering to animals. And sometimes it's just, it's also a cultural thing as well, because there are cultures that don't eat meat. Mm-hmm. So which is to do with a kind of like, you know, a person's internal awakening and their consciousness, you know, developing. But I think, and that's a great starting point. And then, you know, it's again, you know, once you start on that path, you then begin to learn about how everything is connected, and that, you know, hopefully that vegetarianism is kind of like a stepping stone to a healthier option, which for a lot of people is veganism. But then there's also healthy veganism and non-healthy veganism as well. And so, you know, but I think you have to go on the path. You have to be prepared to go on the path to learn those things as you go along. And because people do experience a difference in their, you know, there's just hundreds of stories now how people have, you know, got rid of a health challenge or a certain disease because they changed their diet, you know, because they opted for better nutrition and a better lifestyle, because they did meditation. Because I can remember reading a little booklet many, many years ago about a Christian nun who developed cancer, and she went on a deep spiritual journey with meditation, and how in that process she kind of like was able to transcend the pain of her condition and accept that the inevitability of her death without the anxiety that surrounds it for most people. And in that process, she managed, you know, she managed, spirit enabled her, God enabled her to cure the disease that she had. So I think that there are many pathways for people in terms of what their consciousness brings them to in terms of their diet, you know, vegetarianism, veganism, raw veganism, and the reasons why that happened, and why that happens. And I do really believe that there, you know, many paths lead to the same place. So, you know, kind of like if you make the choice, if you make the decision, that's a really brilliant thing to do.
And, you know, when people do start on, like you said before, they can get into, you know, like tomorrow I'm vegan, that's it, I drop everything. And some people can be really strong on it and stay gung-ho for a long time. And then, you know, they might have one milkshake or like something will tip them back into like making what, you know, just eating something that they may not have eaten for a while. And then they're convinced that that's it, it's all over. How do you coach people through having compassion for those moments when, you know, you're trying to change the habits of maybe decades? And like you say, also ancestrally and culturally. And especially if you're like the sole vegan in a meat-eating family, it's hard. And then if you make, and people will always come and try and, you know, wave a steak in front of you to kind of help you along your way. So if you've gone so far and then you have that slip up, which is not really a fair way to say, but, you know, you kind of make a choice that you didn't really necessarily want to do. And then you start to berate yourself for that. How do you kind of coach people through that point where they just have like a moment, a day or two, one meal or something, and that all is not lost?
Well, I always, one of the things that I say is that it's going to happen. Mm. I mean, it's going to happen. I mean, it's going to happen. And there are different reasons why it happens. And so I remember reading an article in Get Fresh magazine, which is a raw food magazine. I don't think it's published anymore, but that particular, and it was a raw food teacher, and she was talking about cravings. Mm-hmm. And she talked about how once, you know, she saw a loaf of bread. I don't remember, but she saw, yeah, and she had one slice of this loaf of bread, and it was like, whoa. And she locked herself in the room and ate the whole loaf. And I roared with laughter because I know what that feels like. It's just, and it was hilarious. And it was great that she would share that. Mm. Because it's not about being good. It's about understanding that you're in a process. And at different stages, different things will happen. And I remember writing on my blog, the old one, about when my mum died. When my mum died, it was an unexpected event. And it sent us into shock. Mm. And I couldn't function. I was already a raw food teacher. I couldn't function. I just ate whatever was put in front of me. It took me 5 years to get back to where I wanted to be in terms of my self-care and my diet. And and it was really, really hard because I didn't just come off the wagon. I like slipped, what, you know, head first downwards off the wagon. And because the grief was so powerful and overwhelming, and it took over my life. And so I think the thing is that, yes, your word, you know, that compassion is really, really important. And it's not just a word, it's a practice. It's something that you have to incorporate into your life for yourself and for everyone else around you. You can't just pluck it out of the air. You know, it's kind of like the thing, like with compassion, gratitude, forgiveness, all of those sorts of things. Over time, you develop the kind of like spiritual, what's the word, like maturity to understand that those things are about you retrieving your true nature. Mm. as a human being, and that it's okay, you know, you kind of like you find out in that process what's in your heart, what's in your mind, and what's in your body. And those things teach you so much about who you are and what triggers certain things. It's essential to have that information. Mm. And that's what the path, that's what the journey gives you. You know, it gives you such a beautiful sense of self-awareness that, you know, kind of like you can think, well, right, okay, I can plan for the end of the year festivities because I know that if I go to my aunt's house, she's going to have this, this, and this. What can I do to enable myself to honor my commitment to you know, a certain kind of nutrition. Right, will I just have the salad, or will I take a dish with me for everybody to share? You know, what are the things that trigger me when I smell the jerk chicken? Is that going to kind of like send me on a, you know, and make me, or maybe I'll just have a little bit of the gravy and put it on my salad. You know, there's just so many permutations, and it really does depend on who you are. So the thing is, if we judge other people harshly, it means we're judging ourselves harshly. So we have to learn to set aside those judgments and put in place, you know, the compassion and the self-awareness that will enable us to continue with our journey. And I try to incorporate those things into, you know, when I'm kind of like supporting someone to, you know, maybe look at what's underneath that and, you know, kind of like, yeah, all the things that you said, you know, the familiarity, you know, sometimes it smells, sometimes it's how something looks, sometimes it's just being in a certain environment, you know, what can we do to, you know, what can you try this time, see how you get on with it this time, and, you know, kind of like we can tweak it the next time, and, you know, you just keep going and you keep going and keep going.
And just in terms of when you're making that transition yourself and talking about, you know, having compassion for yourself, how then do you also extend that compassion outwards? You know, do you have any tips for anyone, especially when you know you're making choices for your health and you know that you're feeling better and you might be looking better, and then you've got peers, family members who you can see are being challenged by things that you know could be easily, or, you know, they'd start to feel benefit, like say sometimes in a matter of days, if they would only kind of swap out the pop for like a green smoothie like a couple of times a week, you know. And you're just, how, what tips do you have for anyone to not be evangelical about it, because that's not going to help either.
No, it's not going to help.
Talking from experience.
Yeah. In spiritual terms, that the practice of metta bhavana is really, really beautiful for understanding compassion. It, you know, you start with yourself, then you start with, then you go take it out to somebody that you know and you care about, and then maybe an acquaintance, and then maybe somebody you've seen down the road, and then out to a complete stranger, and then out to the world. And that as a practice really helped me to understand a lot about compassion in practice. And also one of the Tibetan Buddhist concepts that about, you know, kind of like not killing a spider because it could have been your mum in a previous lifetime. And those things about us all being connected, but on a human level, that we don't like, it's not nice to feel, to be on the receiving end of judgment or condemnation of any kind. I can remember once going to a gathering at a friend's house, and everybody was drinking alcohol, and I don't drink alcohol, and people kept asking me why, and stupidly and in a very judgmental way. I wasn't, you know, not consciously judgmental, but it was judgmental. I said, oh well, I believe that alcohol kills you. And of course, you don't say that to a group of people who are drinking alcohol, because instantly they will feel that I've made a judgment, and I have made a judgment. And so there was a very difficult interaction. People were, you know, really interrogating me as to why I thought that. But they're making the choice to drink. So it's just not right to do that in that kind of situation. So I would say that know that nothing is permanent. Everything is in transition, always, all the time. Everybody around you, you in that setting, and that when you see something that you really disapprove of, just take a step back. Just take a step back and just feel that feeling, and know that you don't have any right to project it onto the other person. That's so hard to do, but it's a really good practice in terms of kind of like stopping you from, you know, kind of like going in, and also practicing that with yourself. You know, you look in the mirror, oh my God, I look fat today. What's going on? You know, why are you not loving yourself? Why are you not seeing the beauty that's looking in the mirror? What expectation do you have of what you want to look like, and why do you have that? And how can you love yourself in that moment, in the next moment, you know, for the rest of the day. What can you do to make you feel better? Go and have that green juice that you thought you weren't going to have. And that, you know, when that energy hits you, then you're going to feel different. I mean, that's kind of a simplistic answer, but, you know, there are always things that we can do. And so just be aware of your own judgments, really. And then when people come to you with their judgments, don't take it on. Just, you know, don't argue, don't defend, just don't take it on.
Simple but hard. That's so wonderful. But learning, you know, and getting much better, because you can take that beat as well. So I'm gonna go to the hard questions now. I know you were looking forward to these ones. So it was like, firstly, what was the best piece of advice that a woman has ever given to you?
Okay, so these are the hard questions, because when I thought about this, I thought, oh goodness, what can I say? All right, there's two things. One of them was about support, and that was a new concept to me as a young mother at that time, a young single mother, and about kind of like women supporting each other. That was huge, and it's something that it's been part of my personal growth and something that I incorporate into how I am in the world, really understanding what it means to give non-judgmental support, because there's different kinds of support. And there's a lovely book that I read when I was training to be an interfaith minister, which was about, I think it was called How Can I Help? And I don't remember who it was by now, but it was about why people choose to give support. You know, the whole thing about the wounded healer and things like that, you know, often it's people that are wounded themselves. And what position are you taking when you offer support? Because that too can be judgmental. So really kind of like working with that. And our spiritual teacher at the Interfaith Seminary, Miranda, one of the teachings was about dropping the knife. I think that was the biggest thing. Drop the knife, drop the need to defend yourself. You know, because we become defensive about, you know, when we feel that people are trying to make us wrong, or our need to be right, or to stand out, or to have status, or whatever. And why that worked for me in that setting was that many times when you say that you're an interfaith minister and you're sometimes around a group of people from a particular faith background who believe that their faith is the only way to go, you can sometimes be put in a position where they want you to defend that position. And the thing is just not to do that. It's like, it's not about that. It's about, you know, for me, it's about being the best human being that you can be in the world, which takes a lot of work in terms of, you know, personal self-discovery, spiritual growth, and that kind of thing. It takes commitment and it takes time. And dropping the knife in relation to sexism, racism, ageism, so many different things, that's really, really powerful and empowering, and not always easy to do. So yeah, I think that was a huge thing. That was a huge piece of it wasn't advice. The support was advice. The drop the knife was also teaching.
I'm gonna chew on that one for a few days, actually. I really like that one. That's a nice one. Yeah. Okay, next question is, which female do you think represents higher energetic resonance?
Now, that was really another difficult one, because it was like about four people sprung to mind. I'm just going to name, two of them. Mm. Pema Chodron, who, when I read her stuff, it gives me goose pimples. She's so on point in terms of the human condition, you know, the human condition in terms of the things that distract us from our true nature. And I guess Buddhism is a big thing for me in my life. And the other person is Angel Keoda Williams, who is an African-American Zen teacher. Mm-hmm. And but she's also into radical Dharma, and so wow. You know, she was the first Buddhist that I came across that wrote about the experience of racism within Buddhism, and you know, it was like I've been following her ever since, and that was really empowering, because it sometimes in the spiritual communities it's as though we come together, we're all good people, we're trying to be the best that we can, but we're also ignoring the stuff that everybody is having to live with as well. Mm. In their kind of like, you know, present state and place in the world. And there's a lot of healing that has to happen for whatever experience you've had, whether it's, you know, been childhood abuse, you know, whether it's racism, whether it's kind of like victimization at work, you know, that needs acknowledgement, and it needs, you know, kind of like gentle healing. And so I really respect and admire those teachers who can work with present issues and not kind of like, you know, pretend that they don't exist. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's an interesting one as well, because that's something that I'm looking at. It's finding that balance of not ignoring it, but then not being so much that it's the mantle that you then take to kind of like put your point forward. And it's finding that middle path, really, whereas you're aware of things, but it's not something that is constantly holding you back in a way as well, because it's kind of working through it, the healing that needs to be done. For yeah. everyone as well, you know, even if we're just talking, if we're talking about racism, the healing that needs to be done from people of colour, and then also the healing that needs to be done from people who are white people who feel guilty because they haven't gone through it, or because they're ignorant of it, or because there's so many different layers to go, and it's like just wondering how long it will take, and so we can get to the point where it's not ignoring that this is part of our history, but allowing it then to be part of our history so that we can have a future that kind of brings everybody together as well. So it's one that's been on my mind for a while, really, just and noticing how different people are navigating it in this kind of space.
Yeah, I've been noticing Marianne Williamson a lot recently on Twitter. You know, she's not ignoring the stuff that's going on in her country. And you know, she has a voice about it, and you know, I'm just those, you know, these, you know, when you're in that position, you automatically become a mentor. And you know, it's and it's important that people see you speak up, and so I'm appreciating that about her, you know, as a spiritual teacher, that she's doing that. So you know, and I'm sure there are others, but yeah, I just noticed something yesterday, and I've seen quite a few really on point kind of comments, but not where she's diminishing either side either, because I think that's the spiritual path. It's about understanding in context the energy and the resonance of what's happening, without, you know, that's where the compassion, the kind of like the practical lived compassion comes in. But it's more than compassion, it's about kind of like understanding what it takes to make change, what the human condition means in certain situations and how they've been created, and using a language that doesn't inflame those things, which you know many of us do. I do when I get annoyed about certain politicians, and I have to remind myself, you know, that, you know, they're like that for a reason. What are the reasons? Yes, they have the power that we give them at the moment to be affecting certain things in a particular way, and what is the opportunity here? What can I do, you know, to kind of like to feed into that energy, to feed in a different energy into the process? And I think that I believe that's what we're always required to do. But again, you know, you've got to have both your feet on the ground. You've got to be grounded. You've got to be doing your spiritual practice. You've got to be in the space that is constantly feeding your awareness that enables you to do that. Sometimes life is too busy,
isn't it? We need to get back to simplicity to make it manageable, because it's always going to be, you know, always going to be something to do. And so talking about your favorite self-care ritual, your self-care practice, what do you need to be doing on a daily?
My ideal morning is waking up feeling happy, putting on some incense and music to fit my mood. So that music could be gospel, it could be Divine Mother, it could be any other number of types of things. And having a really delicious, I don't know, raw breakfast, that's either like a chia pudding with fruit, or, you know, something that's really energizing and healthy, because then I feel like I've really looked after myself. Mm-hmm. And if I'm listening to gospel, to just dance, what I tend to do is put on four of my favorites and just dance and sing as loud as I can around the house, wherever I am in the house. I love that. I remember I was working with one of Kirk Franklin's songs for about a year, and it was that one, Imagine Me. Okay. And I was going through something particular, and those words meant so much to me. And every single morning, that song, you know, singing it, I think playing in the car, it was like, you know, kind of like a little bit obsessive, but it was great. There's that thing about, you know, creating the right energy for the day or for the task that you're about to do, and we don't always have time to do that. So when you are able to feed into that kind of like self-care ritual, it's wonderful, it's beautiful, because you feel the difference that it makes. So yeah, that's one of the things I love to do.
Perfect. I like a bit of gospel every now and again as well. Some good call and response. Jay, have you ever gotten into James Fortune and Fire?
No.
They're really good. I'll have to send you a link to some of their stuff. And it was a friend who gave me a CD years back for a birthday, and that's how I got into them. But they're very contemporary. So they're quite like, he's a young pastor, and they're very young. They're kind of like a young gospel choir.
I'm gonna write that down. What they're called? James.
James Fortune and Fire. Fire spelled FIYA. The way that they do their music is similar to the way that Andre Crouch used to do it. So it was very contemporary of the time of the R&B, but it just had the kind of the real church message coming through. And even though sometimes, because the way that I view things, some of the things that they're saying may kind of like exclude things, and it's like there's a lot of talk of the devil and he made this and all the rest of it, the music, you can get past it, and the energy behind it will push you past it anyway. And you know, more times than not, I'm with them, and their studio stuff is brilliant. But if you ever hear a live recording of them, it's even better than the studio. That's how amazing the band is.
Wow. Okay.
One of those ones where you can hear every single person is a virtuoso, you know, there's no slackers in the band. And that's the kind of band that I like, where everyone is working hard, but it all comes together and it doesn't sound messy. And that in itself is one, to get a group of people that can do that together, and then to kind of blend it all together is, as a musician, knowing it's really hard to achieve that kind of mastery with everyone being on point and then be able to do it live. So it's one of those things that you feel it. If you ever need lifting up, James Fortune and Fire, some good old gospel, you know, that can really pull you through that. Got a couple more questions, and I'll let you free. So I just want to know what's next for you. What are your next moves?
I think I've reached the stage where I want to co-create things, resources with other women, and I feel that I do that anyway, but I want to do it more consciously and more directly now. So I think in the past year I've been really getting to know myself in terms of some of the strengths, and some just getting some clarity about what my strengths are, you know, in terms of consolidating my ministry, my role as an interfaith minister and my role as sister in the Roar, and kind of like bringing all that together. And I realise that I have some wonderful women in my life that are practising in one sphere or another. And there's a beauty in kind of like having two heads working towards something, you know, really positive to bring into the world. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what I'm going to be looking at next year. And also I'm doing a culinary arts course,
mm-hmm.
Which I'm really excited about, kind of like learning about food science in a different way than what I have done already. And so I'm really looking forward to creating new types of raw food and just taking my skills to the next level. So that's really exciting. And I'm one of these people, you know, who likes to do about 10 different things at the same time. So I'm going to try to also rein myself in a little bit and make sure that I include self-care as part of the package of what I'm going to be doing next.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And then now for anybody who wants to find you on the world wide web, how do we go about getting in contact with you?
Well, I have social media presence at Sister in the Raw, sister spelt with S-I-S-T-A-H in the Raw, or one word. So Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and the website sisterintheraw.com. And so there's lots of ways to kind of like stay connected and find out about what it is I'm doing. You know, I've got some really lovely bits coming up for Christmas, you know, how to get through the season, how to survive. I think it's called How to Survive
the holiday
season. That's it. I just about the holidays. And that's free to download. There's lots of free things on the website for people who have been thinking about or want to explore healthy eating the raw food way. And you know, if you want to kind of like have a one-to-one to meet with me, you can book it via the website. So, and you can sign up for the newsletter. So I'm out there. You can find me. It's not hard to find me. And as Reverend Anita McKenzie, I've also got a page on Facebook, which is called Interfaith Ceremonies and Rituals by Reverend Anita McKenzie. So that's the other role. But I'm going to be bringing it all together at some point when I've kind of like decided how to do that.
Perfect. So that's us for today, and I just want to say thank you again so much for coming on and helping me bring this project together. And again, it's like part of bringing that collaborative effort with lots of different women, lots of different points of view, but all ultimately working towards the same goal, really. So thank you for doing that for today.
Thank you, Carol. I've really enjoyed it. Brilliant questions. And you know, I kind of like wish you all the best for it, because I know it's phenomenal. I love, you know, higher energetic resonance. I just think it's really empowering. So thank you.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay.
So thank you again for listening to Her Conversations. Just want to say again, thank you to anyone who sends a message, email, WhatsApp to me, and also for the people that are now starting to share and subscribe to the various channels that Her Conversations is available on. And in order to get in contact with me, if you need to do so, find out more about myself, Carol May Wittick, you can come to my website, which is carolmaywittick.com. That's CarolmaeWhittick. I'm also on Facebook, and I'm also on Twitter and on Instagram as Kazmick. That's CazMick. Thanks once again, and speak to you again very soon. Thank you.